Whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Five Questions, the podcast where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm Zena Hitz, your special host for this final episode of Season 3. I am a tutor at St. John's College Annapolis, and I'm the author of Lost in Thought, The Hidden Pleasures of an Intellectual Life. In this episode, I'll ask a philosopher five questions about himself. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-up questions are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do.
Hi, Zena. I'm Kiran Setia. I teach philosophy at MIT. I'm interested in ethics and everything related to ethics. I've published on the nature of intentional action, the question, why be moral, how we know right from wrong. More recently, I've been writing philosophy for a wider audience, including a self-help guide to the midlife crisis and a new book coming out this week called Life is Hard, How Philosophy Can Help Us Find Our Way. I also host a podcast, Five Questions, in which I ask philosophers five questions about themselves.
Well, it's great to have you on the podcast, Kiran. This is the first time I've ever hosted a podcast, and it's maybe going to be the first and only time where I've turned the tables on a previous podcast host. So I'm very much enjoying the prospect of putting you on the ropes as I was once put on the ropes. Now, as you know better than anyone, this podcast was inspired by Iris Murdoch, who begins each episode telling us that philosophy is not self-expression, but who also wrote, to do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time, to attempt to discover the truth. So, Kiran, does your temperament influence your philosophy? And if so, how?
Well, I guess listeners will not be surprised to learn that I think it does. I can say some things about that. I think the primary way in which I think my temperament affects my philosophical thinking is that I am by nature timid, cautious. I like routine. I like being at home. And I have an aversion to radical, revolutionary views in philosophy, views that take us to shocking and surprising conclusions. I guess my feeling is that philosophy should not create puzzles, but solve them. It should be a kind of therapy that leaves us more at home in the world. And I do think that's something that resonates with my temperament. I mean, the other things that come to mind are in some ways maybe contradictory or in tension. I think on the one hand, I tend to like compromise. I tend to like views that see some truth in both sides of a dispute. I think that's certainly true of my work in philosophy of action. But and maybe this fits oddly with that. I think I'm also quite resolute or unconciliatory when it comes to disagreement. And partly that is because I don't really like arguing. I think I used to get a certain pleasure out of it. And back in grad school, Zena, you may remember a different me, but I think nowadays I tend to dislike arguing and I don't really enjoy having to or trying to persuade others. And I don't really expect to be able to or expect to be persuaded or worry very much when it doesn't happen. So I don't know quite how that fits with my timidity or aversion to conflict. Maybe it is itself a form of aversion to conflict or something. But I think all of those aspects of my temperament show up in the way I do philosophy and the kinds of views I'm attracted to or averse to.
So I think the difficulty we've run into here is that we have a conflict of temperaments between yours and mine, because I love to argue. I always have. I'm extremely combative. And there's nothing I want to do more right now than to try to poke holes in what you just said.
No, you can do that. You can do that.
So part of the question is about the connection between temperament and philosophy. If my temperament influences my philosophy, so that, for instance, my irenic dislike of conflict makes me prefer views that sort of settle the water, and if I'm conflict averse, isn't there a danger that philosophy just turns into telling yourself in a sophisticated way what you already believed to be true? I don't think you really think that, but tell me why you don't.
Well, I think there are sort of two questions. So one is whether temperament does influence people's philosophical thinking, and then the other is whether that's a bad or disturbing thing. And I think it does, and that one reasonable reaction to that would be to be concerned about the ways in which temperament is illicitly influencing people's philosophical views. I suppose part of why I don't respond that way is that I think it's inevitable. It happens in the course of developing views or arguments that you hit bedrock, or that you run out of arguments. Eventually you have premises, or certain kinds of views just strike you as fitting together coherently and well, and others as incoherent, or certain kinds of approaches strike you as having theoretical virtues or not. And at that point, when you run out of things to say, you're appealing to a kind of sense of how the world is that is often related to your temperament. And I think that's sort of inevitable. It's related to the idea that you get in epistemology that at a certain point, people have different sort of prior probabilities, different kinds of senses of plausibility, even before they're confronted with evidence. And I think that would be worrying only if we had no room for the idea that certain prior probabilities or certain temperaments or outlooks or ways of seeing the world were more accurate or more reliable than others. And I don't see yet a reason to fear that. So I suppose part of what I'm thinking is temperament influences people's philosophical work, but some temperaments are right or closer to being right than others. Though I wouldn't say that to someone directly necessarily in discussing their philosophical views.
One thing you might think is that, sure, my temperament influences my philosophy. I'm combative and I like to think with extreme views, even if my views don't end up being all that extreme. But philosophy is partly about conversation. So there's a variety of temperaments. And so that might keep the temperaments from unduly influencing the truth. But you were saying something a minute ago that sounded more strange, which was something like, not only are there truths in philosophy, but there are temperaments which are better suited to getting the truth. So I wonder whether you think there's space in the world for a variety of temperaments, and that might help get around the problem with temperament, which is that your feelings may end up telling you what the truth is instead of some reality outside of your feelings.
I suppose I do think something closer to the strange thought that insofar as different basic senses of what's plausible or how to evaluate or fit together evidence connect with different temperaments, and some of the former are more reasonable than others, then in a way the temperaments can be evaluated as more reasonable than others. I don't think it necessarily follows from that that it isn't fruitful and good to have conversation in which different temperaments come into interaction with each other and correct each other's excesses. And in realistic terms, that seems like the way philosophy is to be done. Although, you know, one of the questions I didn't pick for myself was about whether I think of philosophy as more a communal or solitary activity. And I think it has shifted a bit. MIT has a very communal, collegial environment for doing philosophy, and I really love that. But it's also true that there's probably, I have more of a sense in some of the philosophical work I do now of solitude, of going into myself in a way that was less true of the kind of work I was doing when I was more concerned about, I don't know, entering a conversation in the literature. So I think the relationship between this kind of idea that temperaments can be on track or off track and the sort of social epistemology of philosophy, like how to do philosophy, is complicated. And I don't really have a clear vision of that.
So we have to move on to the next question. So I want the audience to know Kieran put me on a very strict schedule. So let me ask you this. Has philosophy ever helped you out of a practical or emotional difficulty in your life?
Well, it's in a way a question that sort of answers itself. I wrote a book about having a midlife crisis and about what philosophy can do to help that. And it is true that approaching that period of my life philosophically was very helpful. Although I guess it's mixed in that philosophy also caused the emotional difficulty in my life. Or maybe there's a distinction between the profession of philosophy, which caused me to feel a certain kind of burnout, stasis, and futility in what I was doing. And then philosophy of the kind that I still loved and had to some extent, rediscover. I mean, the other thing that comes to mind is my new book is quite personal, and I talk about my own life in it. And it begins in particular with a chapter that discusses my own experience with chronic pain. And that is an odd case, I think, because I'm not sure that I came up with philosophical solutions exactly, although I say some things about how to think about chronic pain and about pain more generally. But I definitely did find philosophizing about it, that's to say writing about it, very helpful. I mean, I definitely feel in some way that I can't quite understand that simply doing that was consoling. And I suppose there's the hope that by writing about it and other people reading it, that there's a prospect of a kind of vicarious consolation in just having someone describe something and acknowledge something that is difficult in a way that is, I hope, honest, or at least as honest as I could be.
I wonder, does it also happen that your experiences, your practical emotional difficulties have helped you to think about philosophy, have helped you to understand something?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it did at different levels. I think, you know, one is that there are certain kinds of claims that philosophers or philosophy adjacent writers make about the experience of pain that ring true or don't ring true to me. And I feel like there's a kind of angle I have on them for that reason. I suppose it also was part of a general shift that is part of the framing of the new book, which is towards the question of how to think about living as well as one can in circumstances that are non-ideal, and often in quite serious ways non-ideal, often much more non-ideal than my circumstances are. So I had a kind of shift towards the idea that philosophical reflection on the good life should begin with reflection on the bad life. And I suppose my own experience played into that, although a lot of it was vicarious. It was really just the experience of seeing friends go through very difficult things and sort of recognizing that an awful lot of what we talked about when we talked about how to live our lives didn't really resemble philosophical discussions about how to live. It was mostly about how to cope with the latest thing that had gone terribly wrong. And so I think that aspect of experience has informed how I do philosophy and how I think about philosophy more generally. I mean, maybe we'll talk about this in connection with a later question. I think I shifted my conception of what philosophy is away from the application of, as it were, arguments or theories to experience towards a vision of what philosophy is on which simply describing and understanding experience is a larger part of it. And I suppose that shift too, I guess a shift towards something a little bit more phenomenological and also a little bit more in the spirit of Iris Murdoch, I associate with trying to write about myself philosophically in the book.
I have a thought about that, but why don't actually you just say a bit more? Why don't we move to question four a bit out of order and just ask how you've changed your mind by anything important in philosophy? And if you want to just develop that a bit.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So this was going to be question four. What I was going to say about changing my mind was there are views in philosophy like ethical relativism that my views shifted about. But the one that is most relevant is this question about the relationship between philosophy and self-help. And I suppose I began with a certain kind of skepticism that came from the thought that it wasn't clear why the skills developed by philosophical training, the skill of constructing and evaluating certain kinds of abstract arguments or developing systematic theories that accommodate a range of counterexamples or attempt to explain something on the basis of extremely limited evidence. It wasn't clear why those skills would make you any wiser or better able to guide people in living their lives. And in writing Midlife, I think I didn't really grapple with this very much. I just thought, well, it's turned out that some of what I was thinking about philosophically has helped me. That's good. Maybe I'll share it with other people. And I think one kind of shift in my thinking that's happened since then or happened as part of that process and towards writing the new book is sort of looking at this apparent discrepancy between the idea that philosophy might be something you look to for guidance in living your life, the discrepancy between that and the way philosophy is practiced or taught. And realizing, well, like you could resolve it in two ways. You could sort of shrink your conception of what philosophy is good for to the kinds of things that academic philosophical training will make you good at. Or you could say, well, no, we should expand our conception of what philosophy does beyond argument construction and theory construction into kinds of work that is much more descriptive and I think much closer to the kinds of ways in which when you're dealing with a kind of moral or practical or life problem, you actually deal with it. And this is very much inspired by Iris Murdoch and her accounts of grappling with an ethical problem by just trying to describe accurately and honestly and lovingly and justly what is really happening. And I think that expansion in my sense of what philosophy could be like and should be like is a significant change. I think there's actually a lot of philosophy that already does take that form. Like a lot of, say, philosophical work, even in political philosophy, I think takes the form partly of argument and theory construction, but partly of providing new descriptions that enable us to see things in new ways. So often conceptual innovation is part of that, like seeing things through the lens of exploitation or ideology or the second shift or whatever kinds of conceptual resources philosophers provide in just describing the social world, I think are as much a part of philosophy as then the arguments and theories they go on to give. And so I think that's a kind of shift in how I think about philosophy that has made me much more comfortable with the idea that philosophy can at least aspire to be a form of life guidance, even though it's very nerve-wracking to try and offer that kind of guidance, that sort of that your own inadequacy is much more likely to be revealed in what you say and what you write.
To say a bit about what I've been thinking, and I think there might end up being a rift in the way that I think about it between the political and the personal in this sense. But part of what I'm thinking is that, you know, the question about how philosophy helps us with practical or emotional difficulties might end up being a bit of a reversal of what might seem the clearer way of thinking about it. Namely, if we have practical and emotional difficulties, say something like chronic pain, part of what I would imagine, not suffering from chronic pain, part of the suffering of it is the sheer pointlessness of it. It just makes your life worse and for nothing. I mean, what's the point? It's not as if you're in pain because you're doing some important service for mankind. It's just the way your body's working. So what could happen in philosophy or in the pursuit of wisdom is that you learn from your suffering. You learn from your encounters with death, your encounters with pain, your encounters with grief, all of the ordinary obstacles and tragedies and dark points of everyday life. I can see putting the self-help in a more primary place than the philosophy. So that's one thing I was thinking. The other thing I'm thinking is what's your confidence that your interest hasn't simply shifted? That is, I now find theory building, system building boring. I now find the practical difficulties of ordinary life more interesting. How much is it a matter of a shift of interest, and how much of it is a change of mind about what is actually important and what other philosophers should be doing? So in other words, do you think we should all be turning to self-help or something like self-help, or is it a personal inclination of yours?
Okay. I mean, those are both great questions. I mean, I'll try to say a bit about both. I'm still sort of thinking. I mean, one is this question about learning from suffering, and I think there has to be some truth in that, although I'm very ambivalent about it because I'm very wary of narratives on which it all turns out to be good for you in the end. And I think the pointlessness that you initially pointed to goes deep. I mean, I think it's definitely not a bad idea to try to make something good out of bad things, but I don't know that it's generally the case that the good things that come out of the bad things make it worthwhile in the end or something. I'm sort of wary of that idea. On the shift in interest question, I think it is just a shift in interest. And in a way, I think it's very important to me personally not to be a philosopher who says, as some philosophers have prominently done in public, academic philosophy is garbage. I don't think that at all. I think that what philosophers who aren't engaged in anything like the kind of more descriptive, humanistic, philosophical work that I'm now wanting to do are nevertheless doing very important work. And often the kind of reorientation I'm talking about wouldn't be of value to them. So I am less interested in it maybe than I used to be, but that is just a shift in interest. I still admire and value deeply the kind of often quite technical work that philosophers do in metaphysics and epistemology. The shift was more that my own narrowness of vision, I think. So I had shifted to these questions, but I had thought that the kinds of descriptive approaches or more personal approaches or writing something that's more like memoir was an alternative to philosophy or somehow in tension with philosophy or in tension with a philosophical approach. And I suppose the shift is that I no longer feel that or think that in the same way. And so I don't regard what I'm now doing as somehow sort of illicit qua philosophy in a way that I probably would have been worried that it was 10 years ago. Yeah. So I think there's a shift in interest, but also an expansion in what I think is a legitimate philosophical project, but not a kind of narrowing or a sense that people should stop doing more abstract, non-applied theoretical work, even in moral and political philosophy.
I think now I want to selfishly exploit this conversation for something that I'm interested in, because I think a thought that I have been, in truth, the main thing I'm thinking about right now philosophically is about ways in which knowledge has value for us. So, and knowledge taken very generally. And one thought that I've had, or one sort of talking point that I've tossed around, is something like knowledge that's collected, say, in a database or in an archive, if no one ever thinks about it, it's not worth anything. And that's related to the thought that if learning or study is somehow for its own sake, what that really means is not it matters for its own sake, as in if you wrote down a little piece of wisdom and sent it out into space, it was all worth it. What it means is something like it matters because human beings matter and because their development matters. So part of what I wonder is what you would think about a stronger thesis, which is not that philosophy must be self-help, but that philosophy, like every other kind of knowledge, has its ultimate value in what it does for us as human beings. What would you think about that as a bolder thesis?
Well, I suppose I'm sort of sympathetic to it, although I'm not sure it's bolder or just slightly different. I mean, I think it's completely compatible, I think, with what I was saying. But I think the thing you're describing would apply much more broadly to philosophical work in metaphysics of material objects or persistence through time or something, that it has value and the value has to do with human engagement with reality, and that there is something to that. And I'm definitely, I have a kind of humanistic outlook in general, in this sort of sense of thinking that human life has a kind of central place in human life. So that all seems right to me, although there's still a kind of distinction to be preserved between the contribution to human flourishing of, say, thinking about metaphysical questions that might also be made by art or music or other kinds of creative activities, and the kind of the philosophy as self-help, where you think, well, there is some way in which it's got simultaneously got some kind of value in itself, but also it is applied in a way. And I don't quite know how to untangle that. So I think I agree with what you said, but feel like there's sort of two things going on that I don't quite know how to pick apart.
So it seems like one complication is if what matters is human contact with reality, and I think a step that some philosophers make that both you and I might be reluctant to make, or we might flirt with, or we might eventually make, I don't know, is that that contact with reality is always a bit messy. It goes in our temperament. It goes through our physical perceptive capacities. It's mediated through emotions and senses of salience. And in other words, it lands on each person in a different way. Not in a way I don't think that compromises its, in my view, its universality or its humanity, but nonetheless, that matters, the mode of contact between reality and the person. Connected with that, is there a work of art that you think of as being particularly deep philosophically?
Yes, there's lots of art that I think is philosophically rich. I'm going to mention two things. One is the sort of highbrow answer that I would like to be represented by, and then the other is the probably closer to the truth lowbrow answer. The highbrow answer is The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy Gentleman by Laurence Sterne. It's an 18th century kind of novel. It's a fictional autobiography of the title character. It begins with his own conception. It struggles after several volumes to catch up with his birth. It's at once raucously funny, bawdy, full of cock jokes, but also intellectually effervescent. There's jokes about Locke on the association of ideas, about the relationship between mind and world, about the experience of time, about self-understanding. It's incredibly rich and incredibly brilliant and incredibly wonderful. And so that's an answer I would like to be represented by. I fear or suspect that the true answer in terms of impact on my life is the work of H.P. Lovecraft, who is an early 20th century horror sci-fi writer, what he called it, weird fiction. He's very uneven, and he's in many ways a problematic figure. But there's maybe a dozen short stories and novellas that are, I think, quite amazing, in which, I mean, the central trope is that something supernatural seeming turns out to be alien beings who are not hostile to humanity, but just sort of indifferent to us. We're just kind of nothings to them.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's among other things an allegory for the purposeless indifference of a godless universe. And it has a special place in my thinking and my life because it was really reading H.P. Lovecraft and learning that he read philosophy and wanting to read the philosophers he read that got me interested in philosophy to begin with.
Right. That's very interesting. That makes me think of another way that temperament influences philosophy in a way that could be easily seen as positive, that is in shaping the imagination. If through art and literature, our desires, our imaginations, our realm of fantasy, our realm of what seems possible, that seems to me quite evidently something that can help us to think about the world.
I think there's truth in that. Although it's funny, when I think about the relationship between that and Lovecraft, I think fear is very central to it. So it's interesting to connect this with temperament because I think I'm quite timid and fearful. And what Lovecraft presents are quite terrifying visions of human ignorance and human insignificance. And I was very provoked and gripped by them. But it's true that my reaction to them was aversion. It was sort of a desire to resist. And so I went through a kind of phase of, as I did with many philosophers I've read, of sort of at first thinking, oh, I guess this is how it is, okay, and not really questioning it. But really, I think in the longer term, my reaction to Lovecraft's vision is, how do we avoid this? How do you have a secular conception of humanity and its place in the universe that isn't depressing, nihilistic, one of cosmic indifference and denuded of value, but one in which we can, in fact, feel at home? So I do think it interacts with my temperament, and I do think the sort of imaginative opening out of questions is very important to me and is an important part of philosophy. But I don't think it was that it enabled me to see things, in this case, as they really are, so much as to see kind of terrifying possibilities that I then wanted to convince myself were not how it is.
What you're saying about the way that H.P. Lovecraft taught you to be afraid of reality reminds me of this feature of your regular podcast, right? Which is that Iris Murdoch says, it's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher, what is he or she afraid of? So do you want to say more about what you're afraid of?
Well, I am afraid of many things. Climate change is one. I think you could add to that now the collapse of democracy. But I feel like in the spirit of the question, I should talk about something more personal. And there's really only one answer there, and it is death. And I am afraid of death in the kind of way that if I think about it even for a few seconds, I will start to feel the kind of shiver down the spine, panic. And I'm not really sure what this has to do with my philosophical work. So that's a question to explore, maybe. I do have this sort of fantasy inspired by the idea that to philosophize is to learn how to die, that I should assign myself at some point the project of writing a book about death that I will not consider finished until I'm no longer afraid to die. And that will, at that point, I will think, okay, that book is done. I will consider it a success. I will publish it. Hopefully it will work for other people. But I'm afraid that this isn't actually going to happen. There's a wonderful passage in Montaigne's essays very late on, which are haunted by this idea of philosophizing as learning how to die, where he says something like, don't worry about learning how to die. Nature will teach you how to do it on the spot. Don't worry your head. And I have a sense that that's maybe the point at which I will learn how to die, and it will turn out to be depressingly and horribly easy. But yeah, that is the idea that haunts me. And I don't really quite know how it affects my work in philosophy. I'm not sure about that.
So part of the question is, what did Iris Murdoch mean when she said, or what do we think was true about her saying that's significant to ask a philosopher what he or she is afraid of? So in a way, one reason it might be significant is, okay, we should all be most afraid of death. So if someone is afraid of anything other than death, then they might not be in touch with the world in some fundamental way. But I also thought you were suggesting something earlier when you were talking about Lovecraft and the way that he in some way inspired you to be fearful about a world which is indifferent to our sufferings and so ultimately indifferent to our deaths. Seemed like we were about to get at something that was really fundamental to the reason why temperament in general or fear in particular might matter for philosophy. Why not go back to Lovecraft and say, this fear helped me to understand that this thesis mattered?
Yeah, there is something to that. I'm sort of amazed by how few people appearing on the podcast have mentioned fear of death in answer to this question. I feel like that's the answer. And sometimes that's because they have selfless fears about other people they care about or the world. And I respect that. What's puzzling to me is when their fears are about themselves, but not about death. I don't know, though, because the way in which I feel unsure how this fits with Lovecraft and fear as a kind of guide to what matters, is that my fear of death feels very singular. There's lots of other fears that seem philosophically salient, the kind of fears inspired by Lovecraft, and they all seem more tractable, whereas fear of death, to me, feels completely singular. It's unlike the other kinds of fears. I can sort of imagine, in the case of other kinds of fears, what a philosophical treatment of them would be. But part of why the idea of writing this book is a kind of absurdity to me is that I can't really imagine what would constitute a philosophical response to fear of death. I suppose that wouldn't be religious, and that might be answer to this question. But it feels to me like I don't have a beginnings of an idea of how to come to terms with it. And you know, it may also be that my fear of death is just sort of pathological, and it's not a guide to anything in reality. But that is the kind of question that I feel like I want to answer is this telling me something true about the world, or is it a kind of distortion?
Well, Kieran, I wanted to ask you, given how far we've ranged over temperament and philosophy and in general, ordinary life, pain, difficulty, fear, suffering, and the role that things like art also have in helping us through suffering or helping us think about things. I just wanted to ask if you wanted to revisit the question of how your temperament influences your philosophy.
I feel like this is a loaded question at this point in the podcast. What are you thinking? You probably have an idea.
Well, I guess maybe this flattens out the whole thing, because part of what the point of the whole podcast series is supposed to be about is that somehow each of our particular temperaments affects how we do philosophy, and to investigate that sort of person by person, philosopher by philosopher. But I suppose it's a separate question as to why temperament in general might matter for philosophy. And I feel like the conversation is pointed in a number of directions that are pretty interesting. They may not be specific to you or specific to me, but for one thing, right, your temperament is a guide to what's valuable. Your temperament helps you to, it determines how you react or don't react to certain confrontations with reality. For instance, a certain sensitivity to the difficulties of life, it's not necessary. I mean, I think most people have it to some extent, but I think we've all known people who seem insensitive to difficulty. I don't know, but there's something in general about the way that to encounter reality or our search for truth is necessarily mediated through the sort of feelings, desires, passions, hopes, habits, sense of comfort. It just seems like it might matter a bit more than just, aren't philosophers interesting?
I think that's right. And in a way, part of what I like about this podcast format is that it combines two things. And I kind of, in general, this maybe goes back to my love of Tristram Shandy. I love the combination of serious deep thinking and tongue-in-cheek silliness.
Right.
And so part of what I like about this question is that on the one hand, it's a kind of personal question that invites people to navel gaze in ways that can be funny or embarrassing. But I do think at the same time, it's a question that gets at something important about why philosophy matters and what exactly it is. You know, that there's sort of aspects of temperament that are, as you said, kind of about sensitivity to the human condition. And philosophy has to grapple with that. And so I like the question because it's simultaneously personal, idiosyncratic, lends itself to jokes, and at the same time is I think, saying something significant about what philosophy is.
So I feel like we've been extremely serious for two people who like silliness. So why don't we, in our serious mode, before wrapping up, say something about why does silliness matter? Is it important or does it just lighten the load? It's honey for the wormwood.
That's a big question to drop this late on. I mean, I think that's another topic that when I think about things I would like to write about, that is really one of them, is about humor and why it matters. I had a thought of a more realistic next book rather than writing about death would be to write something about comedy and philosophy, maybe especially stand-up comedy and philosophy, because I love stand-up comedy. And I do think that's another venue in which this question about temperament, outlook, how to see the world, how to react to reality sort of gets played out. I mean, part of what we love about stand-ups who are good is not just that they're funny, but that they have a persona, they have a take, and often they're playing themselves in some way. Like it's like autofiction. They're playing a version of themselves. And that phenomenon, I think, is very, it's akin to the idea of philosophical temperament or philosophical persona. Plus, I have this idea that if I try to write a book about stand-up in which I force myself to do open mic nights, I will be able to experience dying on stage without actually dying. And that would set me up for the book about death. So I don't have an answer to this question, but it's definitely on my mind.
Okay, that's wonderful, Kieran. Well, thank you so much. And thanks for inviting me to host you and to put you in the hot seat for your own podcast. Kieran Sedia is a professor of philosophy at MIT. He's the author of Midlife, A Philosophical Guide, and now available in bookstores, Life is Hard, How Philosophy Can Help Us Find Our Way.